I'm Jamie Mahobarak.
I'm Peter Dyer.
I'm Ralph Shuckett.
And I'm Jeff Babko. Welcome to episode 7 of The Caffeinated Keyboardist. About a year and a half ago, I was listening to Todd Rundgren's Utopia, another live record, which is indeed a live record, which features a bunch of keyboards and a bunch of keyboard players, one of which is Ralph Shuckett, who co-composed the title track on that record. And when I researched Ralph, I realized, my gosh, he's the same guy that wrote the theme song to Caton and Allie, which was a sitcom in the 80s that I had learned the piano part to when it was on the air. I remember it was all piano theme song, much like the Cheers kind of hook. And when I realized it was the same Ralph Shuckett, I thought, I got to meet this guy. So we've been in touch since then, and it was great to have him here sharing his perspective. He's had a career full of interesting, diverse changes and events. He was an A&R guy at Columbia. He toured with Lou Reed. What an interesting career and what an interesting guy. We also had the great session keyboardist Jamie Mahobarak, who is actually a second-generation session keyboard player. His father is Larry Mahobarak from the Wrecking Crew, the legendary collection of LA session musicians from the late 60s, early 70s. Jamie himself has been on many, many records for many, many producers, including Seal, Trevor Horn, and Rob Cavallo's many rock and pop projects. Jamie's been around doing this for a long time, and we're really happy to have him here. Finally, we had young Peter Dyer, who I just love. This is a great guy. He was involved in the recent Avicii track, Wake Me Up, also with Allo Black, who he's toured with, and he's toured also with St. Vincent and Van Hunt. He's gotten really into modular synthesizers recently. He's also a user and endorser of Strymon and Nord and Moog and Dave Smith instruments. This is a great technician, keyboard-wise, and a really great player who's kind of bringing up this new generation of really talented musicians, keyboard players. So it was a real thrill to have him here. Three kind of sub-generations of caffeinated keyboardists, if you will. So we started things off with Jamie talking about how he himself wired his home studio. This all happened about 5 minutes before Ralph showed up from Culver City to grab his coffee and join in. So let's listen to what Jamie has to say about his home studio on episode 7 of The Caffeinated Keyboardist. Hope you enjoy it.
What I figured out is that if I went into a mixer that was just a little more, that didn't have any EQ and was just really just passive, which in this case was a spec mixers, I figured out everything was just, it just passed the signal and everything's fine. And you take those wires and just go and really anally just make sure that it's all like really nice and that it all follows the same path, and you can just hide them all. And then you're done.
Are they on the floor?
They're not on the floor. They're on the stands. They go up the stands and along the back of the keyboards.
Yeah. So, you know, nice.
Yeah. It's pretty easy to do.
But you did it all yourself?
Yeah, the wiring only took about 4 days, but it didn't take very long because it's really easy. If I'm putting up like that's a, there are a lot of connections in there, but it just doesn't take that long to take a stereo pair and run it twice, use some scissors. You know, it's not like real cabling. It's a jury rigged thing that works just as well. You can't even see it, or it's very transparent. So, but in the case of the actual place, I had Art Kelm, who's over, you know, build it, I mean, design it, and then
the room.
Yeah, so it's a real room. It's just doesn't, it's not used like a traditional studio. So,
well, do you ever record anything that uses air? Like,
I do occasionally, yeah. And when I do that, nobody's ever around. I always like,
the same way.
If I do some kind of percussion part on something or whatever,
that's for,
then
for,
I don't want anybody around.
Nope.
Yeah.
Correct. They don't need to see the process. They don't need to see what bar was good and how much. Yeah. It's best if you just hear the result.
Yeah.
It's best for everybody. Yeah.
Because they don't want, because sometimes the way they look at it is weird. Like, you know, if you feel like you have to put on a show, you know, then it's not as good as just getting something that you like.
Totally. Yeah. I didn't expect people to come over here to work. It was just supposed to be, I had my stuff at a terrible rehearsal studio, like at a center staging annex
Yeah.
No, not center staging. Third Encore Annex, one of those rehearsal spaces. I just had all my gear in there, and I would just record it. But I could only record before 2, because then the Armenian Nirvana cover band would come in next door.
Yeah.
And that was that. Unless it was direct, you know. But then when we moved here, that was there. So I just, I'm just going to move everything back here. But I never expected it to be a place that people were to come over. Like, we're going to bring the producer and the artist. No, not so. Like, but then it became so much that now. Like, so many guys.
The thing is, people are really happy if they're getting something that they like. And they don't really care about, you know. The only reason why I like to sort of organize things and do things a certain way is just for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because in actuality, by making something that, where I relentlessly clean it and kind of like have it look a certain way and feel a certain way, you're actually adding responsibility on the image of what people expect. And that's complete bullshit. That just makes no difference at all. It's really just for me.
Right.
I like to have nice lighting and to kick back in there when I'm not working.
Right.
Also, I have friends over and watch movies and stuff. It's really not all about, you know. So, you know, and I like it really quiet in there because obviously, you know, it's nice to lock out everything.
Right.
And that's really about it. It's, you know, because nobody cares anymore about all the other stuff. They just want to make something good. And sometimes it's better. Like, I like recording in houses a lot of the times way more than the old studios. But we should talk about that. We are.
No, it's that's absolutely true. Why is that? Why? Yeah.
Because when you're on the clock, it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
That's, you know, like there's this thing that hangs over the process that isn't nearly as relaxed, if you're in a regular studio.
Mm-hmm.
There was a formality about recording in the old days, you know, because we all probably caught a lot of that. And I caught maybe 10 or 12 years of that.
Right.
And with tape and all that stuff, I probably did a decade or whatever as a musician. Because I started out singing and stuff early on.
I didn't know that.
As a little kid.
Uh-huh.
If you want to call it singing.
For your dad?
He got us work as a singer. Uh-huh. As singers, you know. But you would just kind of sing. You'd just yell in the approximate direction of the pitch.
I was on some kids' tapes. You know, we sing?
Yeah?
Yeah, I was like one of the whatevers. And then I remember like, 6th grade, they came up to check my voice, like went up the piano. It was nope, sorry, can't do it anymore.
Oh,
you know what? Actually, yeah, my
thinking about dinosaurs and stuff.
Right,
my voice changed, and that was the end of that.
And that was the end of that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, like 12 or 13.
Yeah,
you're out.
Castrati option is frowned upon.
Yeah.
That's for the best.
What I was going to say was that when you go back, like, you know, the studio always felt like a place where there was this kind of pressure on it, and I think it fed. That formality fed records before.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, there's the period of time when I really got into music was when when some people had stopped feeding that. You felt like the music was more fantasy oriented. It was less, it was more about texture.
Mm-hmm.
And the studio in itself doesn't always feed that if you're hired to play.
Right.
If you're in a band, you're going to bend over backwards,
right,
and take that time and spend all that money,
right,
to do that. If you're back in those
vested,
days,
it's kind of.
Hey, how are you? I'm Jamie.
Hey, Jamie. Nice to meet you. Did you take cream and sugar? Or do you
have cream? Absolutely.
Yeah, because we're all kind of in the same boat. We've all kind of come up at the same time and through the same transitions.
I think I missed that.
you're younger, which is a fucking great thing, by the way. I think that's really good.
Thanks. And
you didn't need that transition. I think it's totally good to come up at any time when you're doing that. So it doesn't really make a difference.
Hmm.
But that transition had good stuff, but it was also a pain in the butt. Like, you know, I wasn't... I liked a lot of the music from that time, but, you know, we just went right into talking about studios and the formality of what recording was. Right?
Uh-huh.
And how a lot of that's gone, how a lot of it is happening in houses and stuff, and how there are certain great advantages to that. And there are also, you know, disadvantages.
Yeah, I miss just hanging out with people, you know. I miss, like, I do all, you know, 90% of my work at home.
Yeah.
And I never see any other musicians, you know. I see my family and my neighbors, you know.
You know,
and I really miss just the hang, you know.
That is kind of sad. Because there was a feeling of that hang, no doubt about that.
Yeah. You know,
no doubt. I mean, I didn't get going. I caught a certain amount of that because... But see, I got started later. I mean, we're probably very stratified in the times that we started, because actually I didn't start doing it for a living until 88 actually.
Uh-huh.
So now it has been a while, but by that time, the way that music was being done, I was already waiting for digital audio to come along.
Really?
because I'd show up and there'd only be four tracks, and then you'd go, well, you can't record that in stereo, and then. You know, and some of the sounds that started to happen, there was all this talk about, well, that's never going to make it on the we can barely record that sound if it's in that register, or
uh-huh.
You know, there were tons of complaints, and then you couldn't record on the people didn't want to record on the track next to Simpty, and you had all this stuff, and you're like, man, I just want to throw down a whole we can bounce it
bunch
of
stuff, right?
But there was no way in the studio in that time to get that elaborate.
Right.
When you're hired to play.
Right. Not enough
but
time.
Bands were right. doing the music that I wanted mm-hmm. to make, because they were doing everything they could do to make something happen. Sure. But if you wanted to reverse a cymbal, like happens, you know, maybe five or six major times on a record, like Animals, like mm-hmm. Pink Floyd's Animals or something. To get the timing of that right and get the sound of it right,
takes a lot of time.
With tape, yeah.
With tape. Now I record stuff off the that. TV and throw it in, right. And nobody knows I'm doing it.
Right. Totally.
You can do anything you want, right? You know.
So do you do most of your stuff kind of after the rhythm tracks are all?
I'd say actually, statistically, yeah. Which is, you know, but last year there was a little more tracking than there had been in years. But that was
really?
Because people wanted to save money, and they were doing records kind of in that way, like to sort of throw down.
Yeah,
and then. Sometimes I'd overdub on a couple of songs or something. It was a lot more of that. But yes, almost the vast majority of my work is like that.
Mm-hmm.
Overdubs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you start out as a band, like playing live and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Were you in a band?
Yeah. Well, what happened was I was in bands for a really long time. And then I was playing in town. There was a point where I was in, because in the 80s, there was a point where everybody just wanted to get deals.
Yes, right.
So you would only play once in a while.
You were getting deals.
None of the bands I played with got deals.
Really?
But I wasn't really a member of those bands.
Right.
So what ended up happening was I would just play in these bands and rehearse and play and rehearse. So at one point, I was in like six bands, mm-hmm. which you could be mm-hmm. because they weren't playing all the time. You would either rehearse or play a gig.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was working 5 days a week at a production company near the Santa Monica Airport, and I worked in a video store. On the weekends.
Which video store?
It was called Video Revolution near Platt in Noga Park.
Yeah, uh-huh.
So I worked there, and then I was playing in a band, and a percussionist named Deborah Dobkin here in town. She recommended me to do some stuff with Don Was.
Uh-huh.
And I showed up for a remix with my Ghetto Blaster. With this Ghetto Blaster, I would scratch sounds in.
Yeah.
And I played a bass part, and using the pause button, you can scratch with it, because if you don't,
oh right, halfway,
it all the way,
right.
It's more like transforming than scratching, because the sound moves in.
But you
got
to have the right style buttons, because not all
set. Yes, cassettes.
Yeah.
Yeah, cassette machine.
I had one that wouldn't do it because they were like the buttons that poked down. It was only either on or off. You had to get a special button where you could go halfway.
Yeah, there weren't any logic circuits in this. Oh, it was mechanical.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So you could go and like scratch with it. Uh-huh. So I showed up and I did a bass part on some remix and then scratched in some stuff with this thing. And he goes, and basically he pretty much said, you're really good with this Ghetto Blaster and I heard that you can play, so do you want to come out on the road? This was a little while later, he said this. And it was with Was Not Was. So that, and then he started to produce at that time.
Right.
So then I did a lot of stuff for him. And at the same time, through another reference, I was playing somewhere and a guitar player named Chrissy Sheffs recommended me to Trevor Horn. So,
Chrissy,
I know
those two things
happened.
Wow.
Yeah. And that kind of took stuff off
Right. And Trevor was so hot.
That was a cool album. Yeah. The only thing is, I didn't actually play on the thing that I think was one of the best things he ever did, which was a song called Crazy. Yeah. That was already done.
First record, right.
That was already finished. Yeah. I didn't play on that.
But was it played at all in by anybody with English guys?
Yes. I think that Guy Sigsworth.
Yeah.
And Mars Lazar,
uh-huh.
I think, did Fairlight stuff on that. Nice. I don't know them at all. I mean, Mars Lazar I've never met. And Guy Sigsworth maybe for 30 seconds uh-huh. somewhere. Oh, maybe we've talked before. I don't know. But they're both really, they did an amazing job.
Well, that record was, I mean, I was a huge Trevor fan in the mid-80s with Fairlight, where it was like my first concert was... Frankie Goes to Hollywood my first concert as a 12-year-old was Frankie Goes to Hollywood at the Greek.
Incredible.
Which was interesting on a lot of levels.
I'm sure it was.
Age 12, I didn't realize the gay subculture. I just liked Trevor Lawrence so much. I was like, and B, how are they ever going to pull that record out? Because if you listen to this Welcome to the Pleasure, their first record, it's Trevor. It's, I don't talk about how do you use that many tracks.
Yeah,
it's like it sounds like there's 100 tracks all the time, and it's fascinating as far as a sonic. It's
pretty amazing.
It's a great record.
Well, also that also had Andy Richards, a guy named Andy Richards, did a lot on that record.
On the Frankie
on like Relax record. Probably the whole album. He was really great.
Insane. So then there was like obviously Yes and all and ABC and all these great early 80s, mid 80s records. And then it was kind of quiet for a while, like Art of Noise, which was another like huge record. It was all Fairlight. And then it like 88, 89, not so much Trevor Horn for a while. And then the Seal record comes out and it's like, oh, or whatever that was, 86, 87, you don't hear something.
Yeah,
Seal record comes in, oh man, there he is. It sounds like a Trevor Horn record, and it's brilliant, and it's songs, and it's...
Very strange thing that happened. I think that it needed, I think that it was just a perfect sort of confluence of things, because he's a great singer, mm-hmm. and it isn't a song-oriented record quite. It's kind of like about vibe and stuff, and it was a perfect thing. But there's a lot of musicians... On that album,
on the Seal record, on the first one,
yeah, on all of them. But I had a fairly high survival rate, like it's just so, you know what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. Although when I listen, it is a patchwork quilt of lots of people.
That's the first Seal album.
Yeah,
he wasn't still using Fairlight. He was using Fairlight.
He wasn't at that point.
He wasn't.
And there's not a lot of that on the record except for on that on Crazy.
Was he recording digitally?
No, the second record was I think 32 track Mitsubishi machines or something. Mm-hmm. I might be wrong, but it was all analog.
Were you tracking here or in England?
In England, and then some here, mm-hmm. and here we did it like Lion's Share, and at Record One, mm-hmm. and at a few houses.
Back then, houses.
Yeah, because he had bought a place. Actually,
is that where house music started?
Exactly.
I remember being in Miami and ADATS taking off. I went to school in Miami, as did John.
Yeah.
And just thinking, is this the way of the future? And I remember just everybody's studio being so janky that it's like, no, this can never take, because nobody had their shit together at home yet.
Yeah, and those machines sounded weird.
Terrible. Yeah, and then Pro Tools is like, oh, okay, yeah, this is.
It's pretty great.
Now it's fantastic. And we all have rigs at home. And you were saying
I got a complete rig in my backpack.
See that?
More power to you.
Yeah. Let's make a record right now.
How do you feel about that? Since you came up in a time that was so much more oriented towards what we're doing now,
mm-hmm.
do you have any thoughts about the way those records are recorded? I mean, is it on anybody's radar at all, that kind
of... You mean the old school way?
Yeah.
I mean, there's like two different kinds of projects that I always seem to be in. There's like the super patient ones where we spend time, like you said, like working on sounds and dialing it in, textures or whatever. And then there's other ones that are like, quick, be brilliant and flip through. They want you to flip through presets because that's what they do mm-hmm. when they're mocking up their stuff and they just want like, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. And so I feel like a lot of the patience is gone because it can be done so quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
They're used to doing it quickly.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And their way of thinking of it is that those presets have this sort of almost like pre-mastered superpower thing
about
them.
Yeah, so that's good enough for them. Like, I remember it was like 07 or something. It was some Usher song that was like a Logic synth preset was like the lead thing. And I recognized it and I'm like, oh man. But hey,
that's really common nowadays?
Yeah. Oh, I'd say so, yeah.
Really?
As far as the software side. Sure. Like,
even hardware, they're looking at it as a lot of the times as a sound library in a hardware shell.
Yeah.
And frankly, compared to 88 or 90 or whatever, there are so many more presets and they're good. It's not like one bank of 24 sounds where even so people were using those. But now there's
massive preset folder that says like 1,500 presets.
Exactly.
Interestingly, what ends up coming out, even though lyrically and sometimes song-wise, the stuff is, to me, kind of a bummer. Sound-wise, even though it's a whole bunch of presets, the way it's approached and the way that some of it sounds, I really like. That's the thing. Some of it's like tons of ingenious things going on. It's just that there's a little bit of an emotional black hole in a lot of it. Mm-hmm. But when you look at each individual element, a lot of it is pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah.
That's the thing.
It's also a lot of it's very simple, too. The sounds and the sort of, I guess, arrangement or orchestration of them and just the fatness of them is just amazing.
It is.
But a lot of, I'm just talking about stuff I hear on pop radio.
Doesn't it seem every element is in your face sometimes, which is amazing.
Obviously
compression doesn't hurt.
I have a theory about that, but I don't know if
please, what is it?
No, I think it's because a lot of people listen to music in their cars and there's a lot of noise when you're in your car.
Yeah.
And I'm more old school than all you guys, but you know, when I started, people were recording orchestras and rhythm sections together.
Yep.
I got the tail end of that.
Yep.
But I've tried like listening to quiet jazz or classical music in my car, and it's just if I'm on the 405 or the 101, it's just you can't.
The noise floor.
I have to keep turning it up.
Signal
and turning
to
it
noise.
Up.
No. Also, yeah. I think when it started getting louder and John, you could weigh on this as well. It seemed like at least mixed guys I know, you had to chase the other guy that's single was louder, right? I mean,
definitely.
So you couldn't have the song on the radio. Isn't that the deal?
Yeah.
And also radio stations compressing everything on top of it.
Yeah, they
compress
it all
too. That's why Al Green records sound amazing on the radio with the low end because they're so compressed and they're so EQ'd. I mean, they sound amazing on their own, but it's a whole different entity when you hear it on the radio.
Right.
For that very reason.
The current version of that, there is a problem that results, is a reason why people aren't listening to whole albums a lot of the times. if you ask anybody, if you ask a 13-year-old, if they're in class, if they're relieved when the air conditioning shuts off, they'll go, they are relieved. So they're sensitive to sound too. But what happens is, if an album all has the same sort of stripe of loudness all the way across it, they get tired of that brand of loudness, which
uh-huh,
is
definitely.
And then they'll listen to another artist, and that record is still loud, and it sounds like. So it's a slightly different brand of loud. So what they're not, they get tired of the sound of it without being aware of it, and they just move to different kinds of loudness without realizing that if it wasn't quite as unified in its loudness all the time, if it had a more dynamic range, they probably listened to two or three songs more before they moved on.
You know,
to
that's
artist.
Really true because there's something that happens in your mind that where you just get tune things out. If it's just kind of no matter how impressive the music is, you know, sometimes you just tune it out. I'm talking particularly about compressed.
Yeah,
modern, you know, contemporary music that's recorded.
All sound all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And after a while, you sort of just tune out the music itself.
Definitely can't maintain 60 minutes, 70 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exhausting. Yeah. Even a ballad is as loud as, I mean, it's like, it's a lot to take in.
I did a job for a library, music library last year, and it was a mostly solo piano. Well, it was a piano trio mainly, And it was, but it was rock music mostly. And there was a lot of dynamics in the tunes I wrote. And the guy just kept calling me back and saying, there's too much, you know, this has to start, you know, loud. The second track ends and the third track starts and it's too soft. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I can't even, it's not, I don't, they won't read it. They won't read it, you know, at whoever they're trying to sell it to. And it was really frustrating because I tried compressing the shit out of it. And then he said, it sounds too compressed now, you know, and then I, you know, and I went,
quiet.
And so I have friends who are like world-class engineers, you know, and I went to one of the guys I've been working with for years and I said, what should I do about this? And he said, I don't know. You know, he said,
play louder.
He said, just ride up, you know, just, and I ended up having to automate, you know, like automate the front to be really loud. And it was just a solo piano, like really softly. And then I just had to bring down the volume as the other instruments came in.
Yeah,
sure.
You know, and it sounded, you know, it sort of ruined the whole, musically ruined the whole piece because it was unnatural, you know.
Meanwhile, they're like thumbs up.
Yeah.
Which of course,
they were just looking at their meters. Yeah. You know, they weren't even really paying attention to the music. They were looking at their meters.
Well, how funny is that? Now you go, if you're ever at a tracking date or whatever, you're even overdubbed with others, with engineers, and everyone's looking at the screen. It's like, is anybody? I mean, that's awesome. That's a great visual, but nobody's actually just kind of, you know, back in the day before a screen,
really,
before you're looking at waveforms.
It's come to that.
Yeah,
everyone's staring. I mean, I'm guilty.
Yeah, well, me too.
It is a useful tool because,
absolutely,
you know, and if you're not playing something that's written, or if you're playing something that you wrote, you know, it's the same thing as people looking at the page
chart
to some degree.
I
don't want to overliteralize
that. Well, you know,
it is.
What
it's
else,
a
what
way
else
of analyzing it.
Each other. It's like an elevator, right? It's like,
everyone
just kind of looks at what's moving, but it is odd. Like, I do think engineers are now, and John, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think there is a, especially maybe
he hasn't used his eyes, and, I mean his ears in years.
I think there is a tendency to work visually, which is bizarre to me, to looking at meters.
When we listen back sometimes, I purposely look down just so, because you know, if you see something coming, then your brain starts to cue it or whatever.
Totally.
You know, you can work in different ways because one thing I've noticed is that if I'm working on my own, right, I stop and start a lot, but do it really fast. So in time, or even if I'm skipping around because I'm keeping track of what I'm doing, that becomes like a performance. But if somebody else is engineering, or if you're in a tracking situation, then what you take advantage of is a different set of variables, where you're not worried about the engineering and you're focusing on it in a performance-like way, regardless of how fragmented your overdubs or your parts may be. You'd rely on that person.
Yeah.
And also, you are relying on their concept of the sound a little more.
Right.
You may have some ideas about what they would do, but you're going to let a lot of stuff go because they're building the picture of the sound now.
Yeah,
and that's a beautiful thing.
It's kind of a relief in a way. It's one less thing to worry about.
Well, they're both great. They're both great. Like editing, I love being able to get a bar out front. I know what's going to happen. I've got what I'm going to do, and I don't need to worry about somebody else. But having a second set of ears and trusting that he's not just letting this go, but he thinks this sounds good. So that's nice. You know, you don't need to wait to put it in a Dropbox and wait to see, get feedback or see if they dig it. That was okay. They liked the whole thing. Let's do another pass. And there are benefits to each.
It's good if you trust the guy or the person, you know.
And the sound isn't going through only your funnel. So when you hear it later on, you get sort of it sounds kind of refreshing to you if you're always going through your own set of ears.
A lot of times, I haven't done many overdub situations in years, but I remember back in the old days, the engineer would tell me to just take reverb, take any effects off everything, don't EQ anything. You know, he just wanted to do it himself, you know. But nowadays, I guess according to what Peter says,
some guys still ask for that, but I prefer, I mean, I play it different when it's dressed.
Totally.
Yeah. Just, I'm sure everybody does. So, why not do it? Like, it already sounds good. Then let's take it.
Sometimes
more guys
I
are
will
doing
demand that.
That
not demand, but suggest.
Suggest.
I'll suggest take it like it's like if something's gonna. I know you have all your stuff passed through the delays and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trav was saying.
Oh yeah.
But I think that's the sound. It's like, are you gonna tell a guitar player not to play through his pedal board and just
treat me like a guitar player?
Can you just do it straight to the board? He'd go crazy.
A clean guitar. No way. Yep.
You know, I went
I have told guitar players that.
That's cool as a thing, yes.
Have you?
That's cool as if that's the vibe.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago, I
guess.
But
can you imagine, like, telling the Edge, I just need you direct.
Yeah, just direct. We'll dress it up later. Yeah. Don't worry about it. It'll be great.
I went through that transition.
You did.
Because at that time, you know, I was showing up with stuff, and the records I liked, or the things that influenced me the most, were people like Brian Eno or our bands like Killing Joke and Tangerine Dream, at least up until 1979.
Right. And
a lot of stuff. And you know, even though Killing Joke is not exactly synthesizer laden, even though there's always a little there, it's loaded with an effect, a certain thing that happens with the guitars. He's probably one of my favorite guitar players of all time. And hearing those sounds... And taking Brian Eno into account, everything is printed. The whole thing is done that way. And I was having a lot of trouble with great engineers getting those sounds with them or getting them accepted on traditional records. Because I was playing on things that were a lot more traditional. It took a long time for other things to come around.
Right.
So that was a really good thing way back when of working with somebody like... To bring up Trevor again, because he was like, oh, yeah, you print everything because that's the sound of what that is. You can't let that, you know, what? Are we going to get that later on? What are we going to do
good
when we mix
him.
This thing? No. Yeah. So that was the beginning of that transition, you know. But now I have gotten – I had people really appreciate it. Sometimes if I print the reverb separately.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If it's not a sound.
Correct.
Where the tail is the entire sound or, you know – the other thing is that now I'll have something that's all reverb, like where that's all there is in the sound, and I could be making it with my mouth. Mm-hmm. It could be anything, and now I can adjust the level of those things for every single part of it that happens, and cut things off on the one if I want to make breaks. Mm-hmm. Things that are very average in recordings now, I can do 30 or 40 edits in the middle of something. And nobody knows because I just consolidated the end and they're not, you know.
It's a performance.
It's a performance that is after whatever performance you may do. It's just a lot of editing.
But like,
it's
another instrument.
Yeah.
They just need to hear the result. I mean, I think that this is the voice that I have in mind and I'd like to contribute this to.
It's important.
This is how I hear the song and this is how I hear my role in the song. And I think that's.
Yeah. I mean, this conversation is about the transition from the way things used to be to the way they've been for the last 10 or 12 years. Mm-hmm. Because for people who are making music now, they wouldn't even. There's a lot of our conversation they wouldn't even understand. Like, why is that anything exceptional? That's what we do with everything, single thing that we're doing. But there was this transition. And the interesting thing is that both sides of that transition kind of missed the greatness of those things. Because there's definitely some things missing from a lot of popular music now. There's a ton of great music out there, but in popular music, there's certain things that are missing. Mm-hmm. And there's a ton that was missed in the old days that we have now. So it's important to look at both sides of that.
Well,
that
the glory
edge.
Years always, whatever somebody calls the best time ever, had so much that those guys complain. I mean, they'll come back with a million complaints about why. It's like we're talking about tape, like... not having enough time to really make an instrument. Like you said, and it's interesting talking about bands. Like we listen to, my kid's obsessed with the Beatles, so we listen to a lot of Beatles records. I think that has not really been improved upon. I'm curious why we're still, I haven't heard a record sound as good as Magical Mystery. Whatever happens to be, I think that sounds pretty, and they were, and you read about it, you think they were using the studio as it, but how brave in England where there were a lot of union rules and how great that they were able to bend the rules and that they had George Martin on their side. And I think, man, it's tough to find a situation that's that ideal now. And we've come, ordering 50 years ago.
Right. They didn't start doing that till they were already
they made some money.
Yeah, because I think I read, you guys might even know more about this than I do, but I think I read that they recorded their first album in like a few hours.
A day.
And it was just, they just played all their songs live. And I haven't gone back, to be honest, and listened to any of those records, so I don't know if...
It's pretty, but especially the later records like. Where they're just, you just go, man, that you guys... And it also makes me think, like, when I've done rock... Have you done a lot of rock records where the band is locked out in the studio for a while, say a month?
Yeah.
I'm fascinated. Now, what was the drag as a guy for hire on sessions? 3 hours, we got to get it all done. Whatever, 6 hours, whatever it would be.
Yeah.
And those guys, you'd be lounging around waiting for inspiration for a song. And I'd think, man, like, we could have done a whole lot of that. Like, really? Like,
yeah. I never had a lockout situation.
It's probably my problem. But I never could understand, man, they're spending a lot. Like, fuck around on your instrument. Some, like, really, we're going to order in again and wait for three more chords? I mean, it was always, and I know it sounds like an old man talking, like, well, it was, but really, what would happen? I mean, a lot of these bands no one remembers now because it wasn't that great what they came up with.
They were living the life, too. It was
a life. Yeah, there was a budget for sitting around and doing that, you know.
But I never got it. I thought, man, we could be doing so much. Like, yeah, here so we are in a
recording
happening.
Studio with all this equipment.
And I've been in the lounge for 6.5 hours, like, looking for another periodical. It's like, man, this is not the vibe. And then, you know, a lot of the epilogue is that they blew their advance. They never made it back. And that was that.
Sure. Yeah. And it wasn't until, I mean, either somebody else paid off their debt or just lingered and disappeared.
Right.
And they either broke up or got another deal or, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, God. I have so many friends who had, you know, I mean, not like thousands, but I have several friends who were in the next big thing, you know, and the band that was the next big thing and everyone was bidding for them and they had months to record their record. They had a huge budget and everything and the record never happened and, you know, and it's really, it sounds great, but, but they had, you know, I don't know. I'm from an older generation than you guys. And I love listening to everything that's happening now. I'm not one of those guys who says, you call that music,
right.
You know, that ain't music. That's just electronics and gimmicks,
which
a lot of my friends say,
there was a lot
like
of terrible
my parents
music back
used
then,
to
too.
Say about, you know, rock and roll.
Yeah.
But I was going to ask you guys if your contemporaries sort of are aware of all those old records and sort of revere them the way.
That's a good Peter.
That's
question.
A good question for you. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Are you the youngest guy?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all those core ones are the ones you look back to. Like, why did this work? It was the 4-track of Sergeant Pepper's is floating around. I don't know if you guys have heard that.
Yeah.
Just like, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
It's all on there, and it's 4 tracks. And
Well, they did a lot of bouncing.
Yeah, but
can you hear noise, or was that
so much noise? There's another unnamed person got me the multis to some Michael Jackson songs, and his feet are shuffling around in the vocal booth, and there's so much noise. And
that's I have an unknown person like that who's got all he's working on. I won't go into it, but. He has legal access to all that stuff, and he has all the separate tracks to, like, all of Michael Jackson's big albums.
We're talking about the same
and he says, and he's using it for a Michael Jackson video game, and he's doing the music for it. It's not a video game; it's slot machines in Vegas.
Awesome.
Oh, those are incredible now.
Yeah, I haven't been to Vegas in.
I haven't either.
New, but. This guy is the musical director of a slot machine company.
In Reno?
Well,
Reno?
I'll tell you something interesting.
He's in Vegas.
Uh-huh. On my sometimes when I work on YouTube, I will put up videos of these slot machines because somebody will play them for like 20 or 30 minutes and they just film the screens and the things that happen.
Yeah.
So I'll put up like some playlist of like 10 of those. That's and funny. It'll just be wallpaper for a couple hours. And they're absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Thematic.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
This guy, he spends all his, and he's a great musician. It's Willie Wilcox who used to play in Utopia.
I didn't know he was doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he
I have to ask some Weetopia questions, of course, as you know.
Yeah. I'm always surprised when people remember and are even interested in that band. But
that is, it's insane. Talk about the output, and it's insane, Todd's output, that especially decade. He's, it's like, how are you having 3-4 records of different things out a year?
Yeah, he went through a period where he was just so inspired and so eclectic, you know. I mean, he used to drive the record company crazy.
I'm sure.
And the guys in the band, in a way, because we wanted him to make it bigger.
Yeah.
You know, he had a few hit singles that were in the soft pop category, and that's what most people know him from. But then when we formed Weetopia, we were on some big music special, I forget what, the Midnight Special. I think it was called. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we got to do like all our, you know, like 3 or 4 long progressive pieces. And the whole American audience had listened to Hello, It's Me and bought that. And they were expecting that from Todd Rundgren. And he comes out and the whole band is wearing makeup. And we all look like Star Trek, you know, people from other planets and shit.
Yeah.
And the music is all, you know, quasi Mahavishnu, mm-hmm. you know, and just people. Like, immediately he ruined his career commercially.
Yeah.
Because he just had this one big shot, this big shot on this national television. And he said, fuck it, I'm going to do what I want, you know. And so, which was very adventurous and courageous. I mean, I admire him so much for doing that. You know?
They had closer to, Weetopia had pop songs later on.
Yeah.
But those first four or five records
are
like progressive rock albums.
Yeah.
Raw and all that.
Yeah.
And that another live,
and more
which
than
is
that, some of them are not even progressive rock. There's some other strange elongated hybrid of things.
Yeah. Well, that's why that another live record that you're on is fascinating, because it does flirt with pop rock.
Yeah.
But then there are these super progressive and the talking kind of about how a single album could change things at one point, and now there's so much that I wonder if that's an option. But I think about that, like that moment, Midnight Special, which anybody that was into rock and roll would watch. That doesn't happen. I mean, not everybody watches Austin City Limits, or not everybody that listens to rock and roll is watching one single. So you think about that for Todd's career. Think like something like that could have actually altered his career, one show. Whereas now, if somebody did that, it would be, you know, if Tom York did that or something, it wouldn't be a blip on anybody. It would just be, oh, cool, he's doing
this. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there was a time when you'd be fascinated to see what Jimmy Page ate for dinner. And now, like, everybody's
and
posting their food on.
Yes.
Right. I don't want to see. That's like a no-no. Yeah,
right.
Don't post your food.
Gotcha.
Please.
Listen.
Unless it's exceptional. Unless you're somewhere special.
Right. Don't post your food. With St. Vincent, who I was like lucky to play with this fall. But they had an SNL performance that was like kind of broke her into the mainstream, I feel like. She always had a huge, not niche audience, but...
Devoted.
Yeah, and people watched, and like tons of articles on the internet about like... confusion, but they like it and they don't know why, and they just were themselves and they were kind of weird and like neon. Mm-hmm. But that one event kind of
Sam
got
Smith
them going.
For sure.
Sure.
From
yeah,
SNL.
Definitely.
I think it still exists still where it can happen.
It's a good point.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely can. Yeah. Well, I used to work at a record company, so I don't know if you guys never did. But
where did you work, and when, and what?
I was a director of A&R at Columbia Records from 1989 to 1992.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, I interned at A&R at Sony in Santa Monica in summer of 91.
Oh, well, I got fired right before they moved.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because
they had
a new building.
They had a new regime. They had a whole new. They got a new head.
Randy
of
was there. Randy was head.
Randy
of
was do. Randy is like the mayor of he's just, you could be walking down the street in like a small town in Sweden.
Yeah.
or something.
Yeah.
You know, in the middle of a snowstorm.
And he'll know somebody.
And somebody's like trudging up the thing and he'll go, dude,
yeah, we got to call me when you get back into town, dude.
I ran into him in Guitar Center. It was the same thing.
Yeah.
He's a phenomenon. I mean, he's just amazing.
By the way, I brought something funny.
Please.
I brought the record that got me wanting to play synthesizer.
Yes, come on, bust it out. We'll post a picture of this. But so wait, how did you, while Jamie gets it, how did you, oh yeah, here it is. Oh, look at that.
It's called Black Mass by Lucifer, which was by a guy named Mort Garson.
Uh-huh.
Mort Garson was a songwriter. He wrote Our Day Will Come.
Wow.
He's the guy who wrote that.
Great song.
And he wrote a few other songs. He's and this record is a Moog album.
Uh-huh.
And he came over to my house. My father was a session guy.
Yeah.
He's not playing anymore and he lives in Australia. But at the time he was friends with Mort Garson. And Mort Garson wrote these songs and then bought a Moog, a big modular Moog, and started making music. And he came over and then he handed this to me, this record, which has a particularly evil-looking cover, like a pentagram and stuff.
Yeah.
And I went in the other room and put it on.
So it's modular Moog stuff?
Yeah, but the thing that made me want to make these sounds was some screaming sounds that were on the first song on this record.
You mean like human voice?
Yeah, like processed sounds that were pretty amazing sounding.
Since you're listening, what is the record called? And the first song looks like it's Solomon's Ring.
Yeah, it's called Black Mass by Lucifer. The by is really small in there. It's like really... And... It's kind of amazing. It's definitely channeling something kind of evil. 1971.
Wow.
I was probably 7 or something. But
so how did that record find you at age 7?
Because he came over to the house wearing some like Roy Orbison looking wraparound glasses talking to my father. And then my dad said, you should hear his album. And then he handed it to me and I went in the other room and put it on. It's kind of amazing. I mean, now that I look at it, it's pretty beat up and everything. It's on Uni... On the most
expensive,
the flimsiest plastic, like the worst pressing.
Sounds like a boomerang.
Yeah, KTEL quality vinyl.
Terrible, but it was an amazing album.
Did your dad ever play synthesizers?
He did, but he didn't program them.
Yeah,
mostly.
His dad, Ralph?
I didn't know him personally, but at one point when I was, this is like when I was probably 19 years old or something.
You were here? Or New York?
I was born here, and I moved into New York in 72, and I lived there for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw his name on a... I was trying to figure out like what a country piano player plays.
Yeah.
Because of like the Byrds and the Burrito Brothers
and
the band and all those people were really kind of... And Bob Dylan were really into the Nashville thing. And I had been like mainly a huge jazz and blues and funk fan. And I was just wondering, what does a country piano player play? And so I got some albums that his name was on, you know.
It's strange because his thing was, he's from New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
And
talk about piano players. Yeah.
And he, you know, basically there was a lot of classical music from my family, from my brother and my sister who studied, and then my father who played classical music, and he played jazz. Obviously, he had a jazz background being from New Orleans. I didn't end up playing either.
Uh-huh.
That was always around, and he came into synthesizers fairly early, and we had like a CS-80 at the house, and later on, and I played that constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And we had...
I'm sure it was sold, right?
You know. In fact, he had a studio, and somewhere in the shuffle of selling that studio, it is long gone, depressingly. And I would have it if it wasn't. But we had an Arp Odyssey, which is the thing I learned on and everything, so they were around. But he didn't program those a lot. On the sessions on the movie dates, by the time I was going, there was a bank of CS-80s, like 4 of them.
Uh-huh.
And then sometimes some other stuff, but that's the majority of what was there. And on the dates that I went to that were synthesizer dates, there was a programmer.
Uh-huh.
Right. I know that was a big... We've talked about that here before. That was a big job. Like,
that's
that was
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that bizarre? And that's back when they were having, you know, when they was considered something else because it wasn't a rhythm date. And I didn't hear those terms by the time I was playing. But I went to a lot of those sessions. But my thoughts about music and how it was made were extremely different than the people of that time. Although I understand it and enjoyed being around it. You know, it wasn't my workflow.
Right.
You know, you wouldn't take five after doing a, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, after doing something, it was just this permanent, like, 14-hour marathon of either sitting on your ass the whole time or playing, you know, a lot. It just, it had changed. And
why did he stop? Are you able to say why he didn't, why he stopped playing?
When he, it's just, as time has gone on, he's just not doing it anymore.
Does he miss it?
I'm sure he does, yeah. But I also think that the urgency level, the you know, I just don't think that he's into doing it, you know.
There's a burnout factor for some people, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Both creatively and physically. Like, if you're really busy for 12, 20, 15 years, and you just, you're just working every day, and you have, like, one day off every few months, and you're just cranking it out, and you always have to be inspired, and you always have to have a good feel, and you know. And then
you mentioned something that clues in that you would not have that.
I'm sorry.
You've said some things that, that indicate that you don't have that burnout that you have.
I do have a burnout. I've been doing music for animation for like Saturday morning cartoons for about 25 years, and it's really time intensive. Busy. I mean, it's creatively amazing, but I, at a time when all my friends were doing, like, I have a lot of friends who are film composers, and I have one friend who had a TV movie that he was doing, and he finished it in 2 days because it was all grooves and pads,
right?
You know,
yeah.
And I'm sitting watching these cartoons, watching the movement of the bodies and the facial expressions. And the people that I was working for wanted everything exaggerated, over the top. Every emotion has to be
buttoned,
you know, buttoned within like a from 5 seconds. You know, you're somebody's elated, and then all of a sudden they get in a battle for 11 seconds, and then they fall in love. You know, and you know, I mean, it's just it's like it's really intense, and so. I stopped doing. The main production company that I work for went out of business a couple of years ago, and I was just thinking, it would be nice to have. It was a steady gig. I was like the senior composer for the company for 20 years, and it would be nice to. It was like just a steady gig with no politics. You know, everybody was. I got along with everybody. They all loved my stuff, and. But I was just thinking, do I want to spend 14, 16 hours a day, you know, making every single thing fit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and exaggerating it, you know.
It's also pure work because, you know, you're very much in the confines of the picture and you want it to pass. You want everything to pass.
Yeah.
Although that, now at this point, of course, they trust you to the point where it's, you're just, it, that's but you'd so be surprised. Long gone.
Because it depends on who the writer of the show is. Because the shows that I worked on, which were mostly anime shows that were produced in Asia or Europe, and then they would have lip movements, and then they would put, the writers would write like one show a week to the lip movements. So the writing wasn't excellent. They didn't take much time with the acting.
Right.
And so they were all insecure, you know, so they wanted the music to telescope everything. And,
right.
And,
you were actually driving the story probably more.
Yeah.
Than
like, you know, there's nothing left to the imagination.
Interesting. I didn't know that stuff was rescored. Was it Harmony Gold or one of those companies, or what was the company?
It was called Four Kids Productions, but you know, you've heard of Pokemon.
Yep. Oh, right.
I definitely watched those growing up.
Everyone on the globe.
Yeah. Huh?
Almost everyone on the globe.
Yeah. And, you know, I scored the first three Pokemon movies, and at the beginning I didn't do the TV show because they didn't want to pay me anything up front. They wanted it all to be the back end, and I had a family to support. So I said, what, you want me to do all this work for nothing? But then the producer wanted, the head writer producer didn't really like the TV composers as film composers. So, you know, I sent him a reel. He had a bunch of reels from all the agents, all the, you know, composers agents. And he liked my stuff. And so he gave me, he said, well, here's, you know, let's pick out a cue, like a 5 or 10 minute cue.
Yeah.
And let's see what you can do on that. You know, so I did that and I sort of went over, I set the bar too high, let's just say, because it was a feature film for something that was big.
And that bar is expected of you at all times.
Yeah, yeah. And when I listen back to some of this stuff, it's just so, it's so dense and busy, and it's got modern sounds, and it's got classical music, and it's got jazz, and it's just, but creatively it was amazing, because it was just like, the only thing he wanted was, he wanted, every character has to have a motif, a theme, you know, every battle has to have a theme, you know, if they're monsters or dinosaurs or robots or whatever they are. And so, and he was a classical trumpet player.
Oh, and so he has just enough knowledge to get him.
He had really good ears. And to tell you the truth, he really taught me a lot, because I was a rock and roll guy. I was a huge jazz fan, but I was a rock and roll player, you know, or you know, pop rock player. And at the beginning, I kept bringing him, you know, these cues, and he'd say, "It's just not getting me. It's not getting me."
Oh boy.
You know, and I'd say, "Listen to the drums, man. Listen to that bass line." You know, it was all contemporary, you know, funky music. And he said, "No, that's not what I want. It's got to be melodic. It's got to be exciting melodically and harmonically."
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got to like, and so I just went home and listened to Wagner, you know, because I think he told me, he said, check out some Wagner, you know.
And I Wagner listened, and Pokemon.
And I listened to that, you know, and there's, of course, there's all kinds of modern 20th century composers that, you know, all the old school films, like from the 30s and 40s, you know, these guys were, you know, like Max Steiner and Miklos Roja and all those guys. They overwrote everything. I mean, it's just beyond, you know. To them, it was like, wow, I get a 100-piece orchestra?
Yeah.
I'm going to just do my thing, you know? So anyway, that's kind of what he was into. So I listened to some of that stuff, and all of a sudden, you know, I kind of got his thing. It was like, oh, my God, I have to do all this.
But it went into syndication, probably.
It's still the gift that keeps on giving.
Feeds your kids, which is the gift that keeps on taking.
Well, you'd be surprised. Nowadays, you know, I don't know if your listeners want to hear this, but, you know, nowadays people don't want to pay royalties.
Listeners do need to hear this, because it's the truth.
You can't sue every radio, every TV station in the world, you know.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other story, which I don't want to get into. No,
but it does bring up an interesting thing in that a lot of the people that are doing things now, it's some of it is just looked at as a one-off.
Hand to mouth. There's a lot of that, yeah.
You know, but there's nothing you can do about that, you know.
It's the deal.
Yeah.
It's the new deal. Yeah. How did you end up in A&R?
you know, I had a friend who was head of A&R.
You have a fascinating career. I mean, this is what it's interesting to me. Like, you've had a lot of...
I've done a lot of different kinds of shit.
No, but it's so cool, because then a lot of guys just kind of... Hey, if you stay in music for however many years you've been doing it, 40 years, would you say?
Let's see, 40, at least 40.
Yeah. So you stay in music that long in one capacity or another, that's impressive. But you've done in many capacities, which is equally impressive. One thing for 40 years is cool, but... a lot of different versions.
Yeah, I've had, you know, I'm like, did you ever see the Woody Allen movie Zelig?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like the rock and roll Zelig.
Right.
You know, like I've been, I'm Forrest in the background of like all these different events, you know. But I got into it because when I moved to New York, my roommates were from this town called Great Neck, which is a wealthy Jewish suburb. And they were musicians. And all their friends from high school grew up to be record producers and record executives. And like for example, like Neil Portnow, the head of Naris, he grew up in that town, or maybe the town next door. And so I had all these guys, their high school friends, coming over to our apartment all the time, and we'd hang out, and we got close, you know. And they were all wonderful guys, you know. Some of them were great musicians that you've heard of, and other ones wanted to be producers and executives. And so one of them was this guy Rick Chertoff, who produced Cyndi Lauper and the Hooters, and you know, he's had just a bunch of hits, and he was an A&R guy for many record companies, head of A&R. And so I was his arranger and keyboard player for all his record dates. And I had met him probably at my apartment, and we were friends. And so right around the time he got the gig as head of A&R at Columbia Records, I had found an artist that I wanted to get signed, Sophie B. Hawkins. Uh-huh. I don't know if you've heard of her. She had a big hit in 92.
Damn.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was
working
shopping
at Dino's Pizza, and that was in heavy rotation on MTV at the time.
Oh, really? Yeah, it's a Dino's weird Pizza story, you know, but which I won't go into unless anyone's interested. But anyway, so I was shopping our demos around, and I had all these contacts at every record company through all these people that I had met, and everyone was bidding on her, and she chose Columbia Records. But before they even knew about her, Rick called me and asked me if I wanted a job at Columbia Records. And I said, sure, I guess.
A job?
Know. Yeah. You know, and at the time, I'd been doing TV music and commercials for about, I don't know, I don't remember when this was, but, well, it's like 1989, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I'd been doing TV music and record dates, and I was an arranger mainly in New York. And so I said, sure, well, what does it pay? And, you know, he told me it was a great salary, and I had an expense account and an assistant.
Fantastic.
And I was a staff producer, you know. And so I got the job, and it was, unfortunately, my family was in the process of moving to L.A., and the job was in New York for the first year. So it was,
that was nice.
It was really hard, but anyway, so that's how I got into it. And I got to tell you, I learned a lot, and I was very unhappy probably for most of it.
I can understand.
Because I like to create music, and that's my passion. And I wasn't doing that, you know. I had a piano in my office, but I never played it.
That was a really...
Strangely, you may have gained time as a musician, because,
you know, I did.
Just through, because you spent some other time doing other things as well. Because
totally, definitely. Because when I got out of there, man, I was so inspired to just, you know, just.
Interestingly, a lot of the times, even though if your facility goes, when you're not playing as often, like being on the road can be like that, depending on what you're doing, you know. The one thing that happens is you start unaware. You're not aware you're doing it, but you start coming up with other ideas and sort of concepts. And, you know, some of them are textural, some of them are chordal, some of them are technical. But you come up with those things on your own without even realizing it,
concepts.
Without playing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a kind of a gestation period. I think.
What a weird
time. Some of it's emotional, too, because you come up with, you start understanding something or that you want to feel when you play, something you want to express. Most of it's really depressing stuff that helps you play.
Well, this is what I was wondering. That period of time, say 1990, 1989, I was there in 91. I remember it being a particularly weird transitional time musically. Sony had so much money still. They had the studio at the Santa Monica when they had the recording studio, mm-hmm. right? That
yeah,
was
yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
I'd see artists walk in with smiles and leave with frowns because they'd just gotten dumped by the label. It was a weird summer.
Yeah. Well, it was a big label, and they signed a lot of people.
But, man, they signed a lot of shit.
Yeah. Well, the culture at that time.
What's new?
I remember that summer, it was like there was still like hair metal bands and things.
Yeah.
Pre-Nirvana.
This was in 93?
I'm saying 91. So it's pre-grunge taking off, but still in the afterglow around. Of hair metal. So
well, if you look at an Alice in Chains video, they look a little like a hair band.
Totally. It's yeah. it's weird. Yeah. So they were signing a lot of Sunset Strip bands, all of which were terrible. 100% yeah. of which were terrible.
Well, it's kind of awful. The... I don't know if record... Well, there are bad. No...
And, they, and it's like we're talking about like the record comes out and nothing ever. It's just like in the 70s, nothing happens. Those guys, they probably spent a hell of a lot of money. Nothing happens, and yet you know you're seeing guys coming. You know, guys getting canned that actually are good. It was just a it was that was an eye opener. I mean, my dad convinced me. He's like, "Your son, you're not 100% sure you're going to be able to make it as a musician." So I was in college and I'd come home for the summer. He said, "You got to try something else out. Try this internship at this." I said, "That's a great idea." Yeah. And I'm really glad I got that perspective from a record company because yeah. I saw how they spend their money.
Yeah.
Which was an eye opener, especially then when they had money.
Yeah.
And now everyone talks about the glory days of the record labels and how they got support. And you think, man, yeah, but. They were not paying their artists what they should have been, and they were spending money in a lot of ways.
And also, you had to, if you were an artist, you had to go through a committee, you know.
Right.
Well, and a lot of the people in the committee, including the president of the record label and the head of A&R at times, and a lot of these people, they had instincts about music. But really, they were very insecure about they didn't know what was going to be popular,
right?
And they wanted to appear,
and
they
were
they
making
knew.
Tons of money. Right. And yeah. of course, everyone, every time there was a hit record, everyone took credit for it. And every time a record bombed, the producer got the blame.
Right.
You know,
in that environment, I'm willing to guarantee. No, I'm not willing to guarantee this, but I would estimate that. There's just as much success and failure now totally. As there was then, that the ratio is probably very totally. Similar. The only thing is that we're getting it through, right now it's all the white noise yeah. that makes it very difficult for people to poke through. Before, yeah. it was that there was no way to get people to actually see it.
Yeah.
There were so few avenues.
Yeah.
Now this overabundance of avenues makes things a lot less special. And the other thing is, if you came up to somebody on the street, and said that you found some way to that someone had found a way to bend the you know the time continuum or something. The average person's response would be, "Oh yeah, I saw something about that the other day,"
right.
and then they'd walk away because they're not just, actually looking at the accomplishment; they're just looking at the blurb of it, which
right.
is a little bit of a bummer.
Ooh.
Interesting. I've been listening to some hydrophone recordings.
Oh,
there are these seals, like Weddell seals, that make these amazing. Sounds underwater. I mean, they're really, it sounds really electronic.
How do those work? How do
the seals or the microphones?
The microphones.
I'm not sure, but there's a guy named Douglas Quinn who did a record called it's just called Antarctica. It's part of a series, and I collect nature recordings and stuff. I don't spend a lot of time in nature, but I spend a lot of time listening to it. And one of my favorite records is by a guy named Chris Watson. Who was in Cabaret Voltaire?
Wow!
In you know way back when, and then left to that band to do sound. And he's a nature recordist. And the record, my favorite one, is called Outside the Circle of Fire, and it's all animal recordings. But it's on a label I love that's called Touch. It's been around for years, you know, but for over 20 years. But that record plays more like an album than just a series of recordings. If you listen to it, you know. He's great.
I used to enjoy the Environments series, the vinyl series.
That oh, was, yeah? That oh, I think I remember the font.
Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah. It's lowercase all across.
I listen to ambient music on the road, like,
really?
Every night almost to kind of zone out. It's more like synthetic stuff than nature stuff. But
I collect drone music, actually.
Drone, yeah, it's definitely droney.
And that's what a lot of it is called. It's called drone music, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
by the way, in certain electronic circles, they call drone music, they also call it domestic, because you can't listen to it. You're not going to listen to your car, so they call it domestic because they don't know what else to call it.
Because it's like the drone of your wife giving you all the shit you need to do for the day. It's domestic. It's just
Jeffrey
droning on and on, take out the garbage. Now I have to ask you, Peter, with you now you're into modulars,
oh,
right?
Man. I went off the deep end.
Which is, well, I know. I saw via social media when it started, and yeah. you admitted that it's begun.
Yeah.
And now you're deep in it.
Uh huh.
Which must make, like, oh, Ralph probably I love dealt it. With modulars back when they were new, I would imagine, right? 72.
Todd used to use a lot of modulars. Yeah.
Now it's you're exciting. Getting into it. Now there's a renaissance of vinyl total listening renaissance. And modular synths. Yeah. What was the impetus and
oh man. Well actually you I'm love sure we all have you know gear gas or yeah. whatever they call it yeah. but I stayed off it for a while because I'm like there's no finite end point you know right. like
Which
you
the
buy this
of it.
Right and yeah. the horror so
yeah.
Made a deal with the wife and told her I'd only buy it with gear that I'm selling old junk you know like pedals
that sounds
and stuff.
Familiar
so, yeah yeah it was a trick because it's like my Corvette or whatever
yeah
I don't have a Corvette.
No.
But
it, modulars.
Yeah. The crowd, like the, there's a whole scene that I discovered in LA that of guys that are not musicians. Right. They're like engineers. They're photographers. They're just, or atonal, like they can't even imagine a note. And they approach things so differently that it really inspired me just to approach things totally differently. And it's, I had come home from a summer of heavy touring and was just blown out from notes and that.
Was it Alla Black?
Yeah. Not his fault. It was
just the
tour's fault.
But you had a lot, you were doing a lot of lifting in that tour.
Yeah, a lot of lifting. And
including giving us the horn charts, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. Thanks. Oh man, that's another story.
I can't, don't you play trombone too?
I do.
That's so funny. Right. Nobody trombone else here keyboard. Plays trombone?
We're
I play niche. Mouth trombone.
Okay, you got. Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah. We have one there if you guys need to. So,
oh, and then like NAMM this year and last year, it was totally different for me because usually I was in synth world and now I was like with the weird modular people that are smelly
and
strange and
special.
All have like weird ticks and they're special, but it's beautiful. Yeah. It's because they don't approach it, and like there's no ego in it, which is such a separation from like the rock stage, you know.
Right.
Mm. So it's been fun, and actually I understand. I mean, I really knew synth stuff before, but now with the modular stuff, I really know synth stuff.
Right.
So,
good for you.
Yeah, it's a very different approach to things,
and
it's great though.
Yeah, and the ideas that are coming out now compared to like. Older modular is just there's new ideas and new sounds because anything can be anything.
But so. The scary thing is talk about
endless
options.
Yeah. Well, I purposely started by buying. I got a Rode case that like I'm bringing this to sessions. This is flying with me. I'm not going to be a basement guy, and it's already done that. And my favorite sessions this year have been where we bring it and it inspires something. It doesn't always make. It on, you know,
sure.
the cut.
It's great for processing, though.
Yeah, processing. I mean, just the other day we were running just like some Sinatra weird horns through something.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
We might have to clear later, but yeah.
I won't tell.
Yeah. I mean, just Buchla alone, just him as a guy.
Interestingly, the way I got into Buchla synthesizers, or the sound of them, was when I was really young from a record called Four Butterflies. Mm-hmm. It was a Morton Subotnick album.
Yeah. Oh, I actually bought that.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it's cool. Now I like the stuff that's a little bit more, that's calmer.
Yeah.
You know, that's more elongated.
Yeah.
But, you know, but then it took years for me to get anything. I think it was probably 97 or 98 or something. I got a Polyfusion system, but it was a smaller one. It was only one rack across to process with. And I got the first run of Dopefer stuff that came over that was probably in 2000 or something. Or maybe earlier, I don't know. I'm trying to remember when they first started. And now I'm looking to get on back in again. The only thing is, you know, it's really good to come up with an idea as you do it. Because so much of what people do tends to start sounding like Andromeda Strain, you know, which I saw last night in a theater,
old one?
By the way.
Oh, the original?
Yeah.
It was in a theater last night?
Yeah, it was over at the New Beverly.
Oh my
gosh. But
that was such a creepy movie. I remember taping that on VHS.
And it had great music in it.
Who did the music?
Gil Malay, who did like the Outer Limits theme.
Oh yeah, he did. He was a pioneer.
Absolutely.
Film music pioneer.
But The thing is, I've begun to think of modular stuff for going back into it, since I've used it for processing almost exclusively, mm-hmm. really, for the past however long, is that the next time I start using it, I want to have an idea beforehand, a concept. Because what happens is, it's very easy to get sidetracked and start thinking, okay, well, the accent is going to be the thing that happens.
It is a sidetrack.
You know? Yeah. Whereas if you kind of come up with a concept beforehand and try to adhere to it, and then as it starts to go away from it, instead of doing the regular thing, which is to sidetrack into something else, you actually go, no, I'm going to make this happen with this. Then you'll end up doing something with modular gear that doesn't sound like a YouTube clip.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like just Matrix synth clips all day.
Right, Matrix synth clips.
Yeah, which is a great site, but you take it out of the bedroom and maybe into the arena of album artists, because there are very few people making albums of that stuff, and there are people that are using it. And even if it's not musical, it's conceptual. Like, maybe it's better if it's not musical, but if conceptually...
Honestly, I'm,
it has so, an idea.
Really interesting point, and I'm having the same problem with music in general. Not even talking about having grown up playing jazz.
Uh-huh.
Now guys can play anything, technically, and I go, I can't
speak
do
for
that.
Yourself.
Speak for yourself.
No,
big
no,
time.
I can't. But guys can, and I realize I cannot do that. And it's a similar. I had a similar experience, and it's recent. In the last couple of weeks, I go, oh, that's not. It's not, I don't feel, I don't do that. And because it's not because, I mean, maybe if I practiced 8 hours a day, I could do it. But all this YouTube, they're talking about in the bedroom, guys play up and down their instrument, whatever mm-hmm. instrument it is, up and down. For you see, oh my God, there's an 8 year old playing giant steps at 350 and killing. You know, mm-hmm, and yeah. 14 chorus never appeases. So I said, but what do you do? I mean, he's, by the way, he's going to be a pediatrician when he grows up.
Yeah.
And there's similar. It's very, there's so much information. It's so hyper stylized. Or
their concept of it is very different than what I would predict ours to be. Because I actually think that what we do is more like if you're talking about not as writers, but as musicians. Mm-hmm. I mean to say, we're a little more like actors, because what actors do is they step into a situation where they care for the character, but they're not always 100% that character. They're bringing elements of themselves into it. You know it's them when you see that. But emotionally, you're stepping into a situation, right? Accessing something in your head that is part of you and assimilating into it.
Meshing with the director's vision of the story.
Without, not completely, not in a neutral manner.
Right.
You're doing something big in it, but... It is like being an actor in that way, and that has to ring honestly, or else it's not going to be right. Although, of course, accidentally, you can do something insincerely that works perfectly. That
sometimes
happens with
you
actors
have to,
as well.
Depending on
you know?
The song,
yeah.
Sometimes but, I realize, oh, I can't bring very much personal. I have to just serve a purpose today.
But you know, when you're
chords.
Looking at it, that's the right thing to do.
Totally,
you know,
totally right. It's
so
like
it's contextual and it's aesthetic, and it's a that's what that's about. So
the,
that's
the
different
YouTube
than a YouTube clip.
You're saying they don't have any context in the YouTubes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I don't know what. It's great to have that information accessible. We're at a time where you don't need to borrow your uncle's cassette of the band to realize what those guys played, and then wait to see the credits to see who played piano on which track, which was great, because that to me, talking about going back to each event had weight, like that to me meant that record meant something, because I couldn't just go on my iPad while I'm listening to it on my iPod and find all the information on Wikipedia. Every Wikipedia wasn't a verb, Wikipedia wasn't a word, but those, each moment had weight. It wasn't like I could go down the YouTube hole and discover and go 9 clips later and feel still empty calorie, like I still actually haven't gotten any I don't feel any better for it. I just have that much more information that was that I got. So
that's this generation, right?
It is
but
yeah. But I think
do you take any of that in, do you take
but you, it is your generation, which I and I think
information lack of purpose
school, like, I know, to where I went to music school, the guys that are 18 are playing like I can't imagine having played with that depth and that knowledge and that at that age, or now even. I mean, really, they're just like, well, clearly they've had access to, I mean, they have the information of a 50-year-old musician and the knowledge and the experience, maybe not the experience, maybe everything but the experience.
So do you think that they, what exactly is lack, is there something lacking, or is it just like it's that you're, context, it's overload?
I think a band.
Like, and if you're playing what you've learned instead of what you naturally do,
uh-huh,
then you're just playing what other people played.
Or you're just redistributing the information in your, I don't know. And it's funny that you ask a question, because I don't know if there's an answer. It's just the now thing.
You listen to a record, right? But after that, you take that information and don't listen to it as a reference again.
Right.
You know, just kind of let it stick in there and then come up with stuff of your own. You know, and if you do, then see if you can make it into something that's concrete, that has some, that is an actual thing that you can listen to, you know? And that is my criticism of the modular world to a degree, even though I love the sound. And actually, you know what? I could hang out to it all day too. I like, it's a great thing.
Right.
But,
I had a question for both you guys. So you were saying that it's good if you have a concept beforehand, before you start exploring and going.
That's just an opinion, you know.
Yeah, no, I know. But so do you mean like you hear a sound in your head, or is it more like a conceptual, an intellectual thing, like
both? There's different versions. Like you could say that this piece of music is going to feel like a place in nature, right? You could say that. And or you can say that you want to do something that's really dark and black, and generate that, or something with some other kind of emotion to it. And the other side of it is to approach it purely from a concrete point of view, which is to say, this is a series of tones that will do this over time, a concept that's a little more scientific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the hopes that it'll be something really cool, because that serves a purpose too.
Because accidents are sometimes the best stuff comes from accidents.
As long as when you, the thing is that the accents sidetrack people so much that by the time you hear it, then the point of it is only the accident, which was great in the initial stages of that kind of synthesis. It was something that, you know, people were trying to build accidental occurrences into electronic music initially, which really did create interesting things. Mm-hmm. But now, if the accident is the only thing there is,
the whole thing's an accident.
Yeah. And it may be great.
Just go off the rails.
Yeah.
Right, but that we're just committed to being way over here, and then we never.
Yeah. And that certainly is not a criticism of the accident. It's just that there's an overabundance of that. Yeah. There's too much of it. The gravitas is not there some of the times. Well, you know,
just 15 minutes of recording.
So, your generation. No, I want to ask this because talking about the information and the wealth of immediate information. I know probably for all of us, and I want to know from you, I'm speaking to Peter now. I'm directed at him. Are there records that you've records?
What I can say records.
That. But are there records that were so important to you that you've gone back to a million times over, and you know exactly where the E string gets kind of accidentally hit, and that you wish the guitar wasn't up that high?
You
the
mean
second,
like modern ones?
No, any record that you grew up that was that important that you revisit? Because I realize now in the last 10 years with so many. I realize I either go back to records that I know that well.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to get into a new. There's so much new music coming
out.
There's so much old music that I haven't discovered that I feel like I need to get further into. That I realize those records, and it's obviously for most of us, it's from when we discovered music till we probably graduate, maybe till we were 24
graduate
or something.
College or something. Yeah.
That mean the most, or
that's
whatever.
What they. Yeah, that's what they
but,
say.
But I wonder if there's too much music. I know your answer is yes, but. Like the St. Vincent record, for instance, I listened to a lot, the last one, because I had that many moments where I thought, man, that's
great,
fucking cool, and this, oh, I love the way this,
I love the way
this comes out in the second chorus, and that had that to me, and there are only a handful, maybe there's two or three a year now, but what's your experience with that?
Oh, I mean, there's so much content now, I keep up is the thing, like keep up with my studies of pop, but
of old and new stuff.
No, of new stuff, just because it's just like content.
Yeah,
and that's probably just general. I think for everybody, as we go back to those records that we grew up with. I think I don't know if that's a quality of the records or if it's more just the fact that there wasn't that many back then.
Well, I wonder. This is
well, and the access is now. You know, you with Spotify, you have. Anything. All music, all times, whenever you want. Yep. Whereas
that's
like,
the good thing about it.
Right. Yeah, yeah, but I used to save up $15 from lawn mowing to go bike to the record store, pick up the album,
which meant
it meant
a lot.
It meant a lot.
And I bought I saved up if it was I think it was $7.99 for a cassette.
Yeah,
I would save up whatever you know, and that tape or record or whatever would mean a lot to me. Sometimes that would be a dud.
Oh, sometimes. Yeah, there's tons of duds.
Often. It rolled off
follow
you,
though. Up with, well, I do remember, like, that sucked. Not one
there's
song
ones that are still
shit
left
production.
In my folks' house.
But
you
it did have weight, you know? It was like, okay, I remember I saved for that, and that was a dud.
There was a difference, though, that
but
you
something.
Would maybe try a few times because you had
time.
No
you
other choice.
You keep trying to like it. Like,
yeah, you trust.
Come on.
You know, you
on iTunes or Spotify, you'd be skipping over.
Yeah.
The music, but maybe in the chorus.
Isn't that just a general feeling or like product of a completely digital product world? Like same with books. Like I have my Kindle now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I read Dune like, I don't know how many times as a kid and, you know, tattered, whatever. But now I have a Kindle with like 30 books in it at the same time that I'm like half started, blah, blah, blah. And they're just, they're whatever, you know?
You're reading more, though.
I'm reading more.
Which is,
we're listening
it really
more.
Works.
We're,
don't you think
audio books
that,
are
but
great.
But that
audio
book, to get through that book that was in your hands, didn't it feel good to get to that last page? Better than in an audio.
I just finished Clockwork Orange the other week on the Kindle, and there was no like, okay, now it's done.
Put that on the shelf.
It's still sitting there in the Kindle, like... Yeah,
it would be harder
no finite.
to read the same amount, though. That has changed the way that I read. I probably read a lot more.
You don't have to carry 20.
You
books.
Do a lot more than I used to.
But what were the records that meant
a lot to you? Then?
Oh, to me?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there was like Dad had his LPs that and like gave me the record player and whatnot at like 12 or something. It was Return Forever Romantic Warrior. Nice. That was the one where I was like, keyboards are badass. Yeah.
They can be cool too.
Yeah. Deep Purple Made in Japan.
Nice.
Yes Lord, songs. Man.
Yeah.
I heard that before I heard Yes Studio ones. Mm-hmm. So, and same with the Deep Purple Live before I heard the studio ones. So.
Yeah, those are really
and Songs in the Key
ones.
Of Life. Yeah.
Oh, songs in the Key of Life. No one, see, this shape, clearly this shape.
Yeah. Did.
Because really, those four records, I go, oh yeah, that's you.
Oh,
I
good.
Got you
so
in
are
there.
Those
good,
like good. Desert island choices?
Yeah, I think so. Probably. I've discovered new desert island ones, but yeah.
Yes, Songs is a triple album, isn't it?
A double. Album.
Is it a double?
And then Key in the Life was two plus the little like.
The little,
four and had five. One triple at one point, but it wasn't that one. Maybe they didn't then. Come to think of it, because I can't think of anything else that would have been a triple.
No,
the
maybe Topographic Ocean.
That's a double. I like it. Though.
Oh, you do? Okay. I feel like I'm still catching up on Alan Toussaint or whatever it is. I've got 60 years of or if we go back, you know, you know, Mead, Lux, Lewis, whatever it is. I mean, there's generations now upon generations that I'm still catching up on.
How do you prioritize?
I don't know.
Well, you have access to a lot of it depending on what shows up on streaming services. And that is really great.
Right.
They have to restructure the payment system.
Yes.
But it's great because now, you know, we can mention a record to somebody. And even though the fun of having it be a rather exclusive club.
Check it out immediately.
The pretension of it is kind of fun.
Right.
You know, it's nice to have it be over because you can really listen now.
Immediately,
you know.
Like, yeah, you want so-and-so says, oh my God, I just discovered,
is that,
right now.
Like, changing the way, the nature of music, possibly? Like, we're shifting from label, 70s, 6 months for a snare sound, to, like, instant song making, instant listening, instant content.
It, it can also mean 6 months for a snare sound because you're not answering to anybody.
That's true. Right. There's
as
no,
well, I mean, I'm not being contrary, because most of the time that's not
going
to be
the
case.
Time now. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know. I mean, mostly not. Mostly the opposite, like you're saying.
Yeah.
But I think that is a shift.
Yeah. But I read these old, I'm a nerd, and if I'm on the road, I bring these old, you can buy old Rolling Stones from the 70s. I have a bunch in here. Got a record parlor or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'll look at, and the ads are all, my friend and I were looking at them last night, it's all, you know, turntables, cassette decks,
yeah,
cigarettes, but and album and new album by so-and-so. And you realize in Rolling Stone that people taking out full and half page ads are artists you never heard of, and you know those budgets were big.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
coming out on RSO, you know, the whatever band that you've never heard of, and they all look like just generic bearded long haired guys. You go, they put a lot of money into this, and who knows how many months they, and we have no.
There is an interesting
thing. No, now you just need a Facebook page.
It might as well be, you know.
There is one small advantage, though, and that is that if you look at a lot of those ads, you would find that the people who are writing what little blurbs are there and a lot don't match the artist at all. They obviously have nothing to do with the feeling of the artist. This is the one advantage that they have. Now, you can shape the way all that stuff looks and the information you put out. And you also don't need to have some hokey line about, like, what...
Tagline, yeah, right.
Yeah, like, you know, the sound of the city. Yeah. Lou Reed.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe he liked that. Yeah. I don't know. But, you know, the first Lou Reed album, I remember seeing some ad for that where I go, that doesn't match, like, where this is coming from.
And he's, like, trying to make him a tough street.
Yeah. I think Steve Howe was playing on that first Lou Reed album, by the way. A couple guys. Yeah, I'm trying to think of who else. It was just strange.
Wow.
Which was the first one?
It's just called Lou Reed.
Yeah.
I did a tour with Lou Reed for the
which
Walk on the Wild Side.
Oh, wow. For the Transformer or the Greatest Hits Walk on the Wild Side record.
No,
I don't know if that had a tour.
Who else was early on that tour?
Wow, yeah. Who else was on that?
Come on,
a bunch of guys that you've never heard of.
Uh huh. What were you?
I mean,
if
I can mention their names, but the only one who. Who was the leader of the band was Moogie Klingman, who was in Utopia with me, and the
so
rest,
there were two keyboard players.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, no, I played guitar also.
Uh-huh.
Lou at the time, I don't know what he's like now, but
he's not
like alive.
Oh yeah, that's right.
He's quiet.
I know
he's
what he's
really
like
quiet.
Now.
He's very quiet.
Yeah, he doesn't rock.
But he was really into, like, raw, uneducated, not slick, you know. And when that song became a hit, "Walk on the Wild Side," he got this band from Long Island that were like 16-year-old kids called the Toys. And they started going on the road with him, but they couldn't play.
For his live album, like Rock and Roll Animal and a few other things?
No, way before, for the Transformer.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So he got this raw teenage garage band to play with him, but somebody, after a couple of gigs, somebody said, these guys really suck, you got to get some professionals. And so they hired the Moogie Klingman to put together a band. To continue the tour, but actually most of the guys, none of the other guys in the band you haven't ever heard of. They're all great.
What was your rig? Do you remember what you were playing on that tour?
Well, I was playing a Gibson S335, I think, and I was just playing rhythm guitar. Uh-huh. What happened was I had a probably a Rhodes and a Hammond. And Lou was going to fire me because he said I just sounded too professional.
Yeah. That was the time, and it still happens. We don't want session guys.
Yeah,
that means,
yeah.
That means...
So, my friend Moogie, God bless him, he said, Ralph also plays guitar, you know. And I said, you know, what are you talking about? I played a little guitar, but... And so Lou said, oh, yeah? And he said, let me hear you play guitar. And so the guitar player gave him me his spare guitar, and I started playing on one of the songs, and all his songs are three-chord songs. And he loved it. You know, it was raw.
That's awesome.
You know?
Oh, cool.
And so I played more guitar on that tour than I did keyboards.
How long was that tour? How long was the all,
probably
the sum
about
total
a,
of them?
A couple of months, I guess. Maybe two or three months, and it was wild because it was the audiences were just, it was the beginning of glitter rock, and you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and Lou Reed being a, you know, a decadent guy, and it was just wild.
Look at the back cover of Transform, and you know it's not going to be a normal thing, man. It's wild.
That means you were there.
Yeah.
I was there. I can't remember
that's
most
what
of
saying.
It.
That's how we know you were there.
Just you know, just, so just cool. To give you an example, and this is I don't know, I don't want to say anything disrespectful to anybody, but the first gig that we had was I think it was in Kansas City, and at the end of the show, all these women, you know, came to our hotel. We came back to the hotel, and there was like. On our floor, we all were on the same floor. On our floor, there was like about 100 young women just waiting for us, you know.
And, right on.
And, and we were all in shock. You know, we were so innocent.
Right.
We didn't even, you know, I was a studio musician mainly, you know, and I didn't even, to be honest, I didn't even know about any of that shit, right. You know. Not really. And,
But after that night.
So we all just kind of went into our rooms and went to sleep. Yeah. And then the next morning, like, we were having breakfast in the restaurant, and this guy, Moogie, he was an intense guy, and he said, do you realize what we missed last night? Tonight, we got to, like, get on it, you know? And the next night, I came back to my room, and like the room had hundreds of people in it. You know, mm-hmm. Me and my roommate, I can't remember which guy it was, but there was hundreds of people in the room, and they were all like getting high, and they all had glitter faces and painted bodies and, you know, things on their nipples and men and women, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and the music was playing really loud and everyone was totally decadent and stoned out, and people were, you know, making out and going in the bathroom to have sex, yeah. and it was just wild.
That sounds great, man.
And
rock history.
It could get tiring, but still, yeah. great.
It was wild. But it had nothing to do with music, you know.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, I liked I loved his songs. I loved his poetry, and he's a brilliant guy.
The lyrics are amazing.
Yeah, his lyrics are just so, and he was an education. just talking to him, you know, was an education. But the guys in the band, I think I think they're all dead, actually.
Wow.
A couple of them died really young.
Well, that's unfortunately a byproduct of that lifestyle to a degree.
Yeah, what, definitely. I remember reading a rock encyclopedia when I was really young, a New Musical Express one, an NME one. You realize how many people leave bands and never come back, or they're just a tiny little footnote somewhere. All those footnotes were devastating for the individuals involved. They're like major stuff, you know? And that's one of the interesting things about being a session musician is that you're constantly moving around, you know? And even though I've had a few things that went awry, you know, over time that really hurt a lot, you know, things I was involved in and, you know, where I was either kicked off of it or it just didn't work out or something. And those things, I had lots of sleepless nights over.
Yep.
I always had somewhere else to go.
That's right.
And when you think about some of these people, you go, oh God, that's must be really hard to deal with.
Oh yeah.
Cause I mean, to get there, you had to
a
be
a lot of them were
it.
Like, they just happened to go to high school together or something, or they live in the same neighborhood or whatever.
Well, the difference between the session musician, I think, is it's a skill set. You know, everyone has different strengths and weaknesses, but you have to kind of like, I think, a lot of different kinds of music. You have to respect.
Yeah, you have to enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I think you have to enjoy it on some level. Because, you know, when I was coming up, you know, a lot of jazz musicians, I was a jazz fanatic, and a lot of jazz musicians did sessions, and they always used to talk about what bullshit it was, and, you know, that I have to do this because just to support my art and all this stuff like that. And I definitely do not subscribe to that frame of mind. You know, I think that's really, it's just destructive, self-destructive, unkind. It's unhumanistic.
Yeah.
And it was really a big deal, at least in New York. it was a really big deal for
well, they
for
had the
many.
Jazz to support the heroin habit, which was nice.
And that's right. Yeah.
The jazz habit.
But however, I must tell you, you know, a lot of these like metal bands and stuff, you know, my son was really into metal, you know, and some of these bands like, you know, Avenged Sevenfold and, I mean, these guys are superb.
I played
musicians.
On one of their records, and that was
did
very
you really?
Difficult to do what I had to do. There are a lot of keyboard players who could have done it very easily, but what I had to do was difficult. I made it through.
They're really.
I mean, I don't know them, but I did play, and they were producing it. There is an economy to some of these guys. Like, you know, Meshuggah is one of my favorite bands.
I haven't heard them, but
the drummer from that band, Thomas Hawk. If you actually, although I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but if his playing is really efficient and like his time is amazing, even though the records are pretty tweezed, when he plays it live, it's amazing. And also another one of my favorite drummers is Hellhammer, who's a guy who played in Mayhem, and he played in a whole bunch of black metal bands. And those guys, although he's a lot of the times not playing real drums, there's certain kind of triggers, he can play. He can seriously play. And I get the feeling that, and they can play slow as well, you know?
They don't as hard as you think they would sometimes. A lot of the economy is...
I mean, strangely, Thomas Hawk's playing reminds me a little bit of Kurt Biscaris. When he hits a snare, it kind of has this sort of thing that's kind of like him. I cannot describe that to you, but it's a way of playing and a discipline. It used to be that the guys who played... in those bands couldn't play slow, or when they had to make those transitions, boy, there'd be fallout from the fact that they were blast beating before it. But drums have taken a giant step upward. It's incredible. Yeah. And metal, there's a black metal kind of move things into a place where, even though I don't really like synthesizers and a lot of that, some of those guys actually ended up doing electronic records here and there that were pretty good.
Right.
And it moved into a more textural element, yet they were still kind of calling it black metal.
Right.
Oh, really?
Huh? Yeah, which is weird.
Yeah.
I mean, not all those records are good or anything, but, you know, it kind of transcends the guitar.
Really? So I haven't heard any of the keyboard stuff. I probably should.
Well, I mean, they're kind of guitar records, but when you're playing that abstractly, and some of it doesn't need to sound good, it just becomes another thing entirely. It's just, even though they're using guitars, it just doesn't feel, you don't feel the it's very far removed from hearing the fingers on the frets.
Yeah.
Which makes you think of it differently, you know? And keyboards are that way in that we always have a mechanical reaction between us and the notes, no matter what we're playing, even though probably all of us have been enlisted to play tubular bells or vibes at some time simply because of the
keyboard
structure.
Yeah, right.
But, otherwise we always have a mechanical result. So when you hear metal records of a certain sort, the frets, you stop hearing that to a degree. In black metal, really, because it's really crudely recorded.
Right.
So it kind of makes you not even understand what you're hearing.
So there's no sort of... there's no nuances in the picking.
In the picking, not a lot. With certain bands. Yeah, it's more like just little shards of harmony that go around. The harmonies are more complex than it was in like death metal.
But it's really not that far removed from if you sequenced something step by
step. Right.
It's not that, as far as an input side.
Some of those bands are composing it that way.
Totally that way. I mean, it's just a matter of how they're getting it to tape, as it were. I mean, on using a guitar rather than... And they're able to produce it, right? Real time.
The metal forum of caffeinated keyboardists here.
Yeah.
You know what really amazes me, and it's a challenge to me to this day, is like, in order to play fast on any instrument, you have to be really relaxed.
Yeah.
And
me too.
Yeah, and you know, when you have a really loud guitar amp behind you, or next to you, and it's just, you know, and it's just loud. It's painfully loud. This is something I've worked on, and I still don't have it down. It's really hard to relax.
Absolutely.
When you got that in your ear.
No, it's tough. If you grew up, which all of us did, playing in rock bands to somebody, it's not the easiest thing to play relaxed or not. Like we were talking about before we started rolling tape, like playing more lightly.
Yeah.
I think we got accustomed to perhaps in rock bands playing hard, like banging.
Yeah. Smacking roads.
There's this heroism that people associate with the loudness, whereas really all you're doing is just turning up one knob. It's not that big a deal. So it's a little frustrating.
I mean, every band I've ever been in, you know, everyone says to the guitar player, could you just turn down a little bit? And they start really low.
Yeah.
I mean, they start at a reasonable level, which is already super loud. And then they just automatically get louder.
On the St. Vincent tour, there were no amps. It was great.
Well,
it was those Kemper profiling amps.
Those are great. And the Fractal ones are great, too.
Yeah. So, cause I guess she got tired of like getting backline ones that were inconsistent or whatever. So it was so dialed in and so nice and everything.
They
sound great.
Which one are they?
Kemper profiling amps. I mean, used to poo-poo like digital guitar stuff, but it's gone leaps and bounds.
Sure. Could you get into using those in a rig of your own?
On keys?
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah.
I've been thinking about that lately.
I'm sure. Yeah.
We did
get
a demo for
sound or whatever.
We did a demo for Native Instruments 10 years ago, I suppose, and they were wanting to demo Guitar Rig Live. 10 years. I'm saying 10 years
ago. Now
it's
like Guitar Rig 5,
I
think.
So 10 years ago, it was mine. Yep. And we went in to do the demo. It was like at Native Instruments, at a bar underneath Native Instruments, and all the NAMM people were coming down to Hollywood to see how's this working. They had a band come demo it. And what we realized during the kind of rehearsal is that this doesn't work. The latency is terrible. But this is scheduled. What are we gonna do? And I remember we went into the demo and their PowerPoint had crashed. So they don't. So we're going to look. You can use technology live. It's foolproof. And now even their PowerPoint is not working. And the bass player turns to me and says, you know the thing about technology? Never fucking works. Well, this is going to be a good point for our demo that's coming up. So we got up there and it was everything was late and you couldn't lock into any. I mean, this again, 10 years ago. And I remember turning to the same bass player and they said, do you have some words about how great Guitar Rig is to tell the people?
No.
Oh man, I can definitely see myself using this live. And I just remember, you are so full of shit. This is so. But it's so. You're talking about how far it's come.
Yeah. Now it's like now live. I can't do without guitar.
Yeah.
Rig, strangely, because because I use it a lot.
Tells you how much it's. I mean, really,
it got better.
It was unusable then, and now it's completely like you said. It's why wouldn't you? I mean, it's.
But it took so long. In fact, it took a long time. Even though I will say that the initial software version of the Prophet 5 when it came out, actually, I mean, it doesn't sound like a Prophet 5, but it sounds really good.
That's cool, yeah.
It was a really early one. And a long time ago, I got rid of my PPG because I love the PPG software. That actually replaced the PPG. Yeah. It was the only thing where I was able to replace it. Mm-hmm. Even though there were a lot of good early soft synths, there were a bunch that never matched up to the hardware, even in feeling. I wasn't looking to duplicate. I was looking to be able to play them and use them. And early on, even while trying to dedicate myself to it at times, it was impossible to perform with them. So what? It's been maybe 6 or 7 or 8 years now. It's been okay. It got better really fast.
Had to,
you know?
Had to actually be usable.
Yeah.
I think people realized that there were, you know, you had to make that. I mean, that's great.
I have 100% software rig, like now on some things, which a year ago even I would have been like fighting against, just because the tech's up there.
You would have given me shit if I had 100%.
I know it's terrible. It's just
I can't believe it. Tells you it got good.
No, yeah, it's
tells you it got good.
I've done some gigs recently. I went out again for a little while. I don't tour that much, but I might be doing some this year, and I'm doing and really my rig is going to end up being a Nord Stage and a couple of laptops.
That's what I got, Nord Stage and Live. Yeah,
that combination is just fantastic.
That's it, yeah.
And with the Stage there, you know, even though I wish that there were some more definable split points,
yeah,
right.
F&B isn't everything there.
Think about it, and then separate effects for each section, which there's not.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You could still somehow manage to get a lot if you have it, you know. I might add one thing. I just don't know what to add yet. I'm thinking about it.
So Nord is you got both of your preferences.
Stage.
Nord Stage,
it's so,
2.
It's so performance.
Exactly. Yeah.
So performance friendly. Performer
really.
Friendly.
Some of it. And what's the action like?
It's good. You know, for pianos, it doesn't exactly feel like this, but it's But it has a good feeling.
It's like a weight
of semi weight, yeah. Whatever they call
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah. Mush.
Because also, sometimes when you hit the thing, they bounce.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, that's the whole battle,
play
like
softer, Peter. You gotta play lighter. You gotta play.
I was thinking about that. To come back to that, I remember in college, like I had a Juno 60, and eventually realizing that it doesn't matter how hard I hit this thing because there's no velocity sensitivity. Right. But I still like, yeah,
yeah. I'm rocking
it's
now.
Not doing anything. No, just I know. Play softer.
That brings you to this other thing. How where do if you your do hands that? Are not in shape, it's harder to play those soft keyboards for whatever reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know
yeah.
why, but it just is.
How do you so how do you not pound when
I don't
you're
know.
Playing loud music?
I've, oh, man,
I mean, because that's been hard. My challenge for my whole
I don't
life.
Think we've
Percocet.
That.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
It's all like every guitarist knows their guitar and how exactly that feels. Like every different keyboard action, I believe, has that same, you know.
In-ears
like
helped,
little...
I think. In-ear
yeah.
helped.
I'd say I never
bit.
Got
yeah,
the in-ears. Custom in-ears.
Oh,
yeah. That helps a lot.
The generic one. Because I don't tour much, but I did like three tours with Todd about, you know, the last one was about 2 years ago. And I really hadn't played in 25 years. I hadn't played with people, really, in 25 years, and let alone in front of an audience. And I figured, you know, I didn't want to spend to get professional in-ears because, you know, I didn't want to spend that much money.
It's worth
and,
it.
Yeah,
it's
totally
worth it. And so I used the generic ones, and it was just a nightmare.
No, it's not. That's
yeah.
a nightmare.
Oh, my God.
I just went on something with very loud guitars that were when we were using regular monitors. It wasn't a full tour. It was just something I wanted to do, and it was only like 6 or 7 gigs. But what I did was I used – I got custom reduction ones.
Yeah.
And just taking it down 15%.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
everybody
I
else
have those.
Was not hearing properly, and the guitars were so loud, and they were using like traditional earplugs,
yeah, yeah.
Couldn't tell what was going.
You get the molded
great.
With like the. 20
you have a good monitor
filter.
Person.
Yeah. Oh,
good
it's
monitor
amazing.
Person
yeah.
and those.
I got those.
You're in.
Yeah,
and
yeah
it
changes
your
work.
Life.
Yeah. Although for some reason the ones I got a few years ago don't fit anymore. I don't know if my head shrunk.
I've been told that can happen.
Yeah,
yeah. You
oh,
got
they,
an
old pair.
Get them refit. It's especially if you're going to do that.
Yeah.
It's again kind of like we're saying soft synths have become a necessary yeah. and actually a preferred. Method of getting mm-hmm. sound. I think as I resisted that, you know, especially playing, if I have to play trombone or sing, sometimes it's a little weird with inside your head stuff. But as far as playing a keyboard or a piano even and getting a mix and drowning out white noise and cymbals and guitars, it's the only way. Now yeah. I can really monitor how to, especially if I play an acoustic piano, really monitor how hard
and you,
I play.
And you
I
just,
don't bang anymore.
And you just... You can just tell your monitor guy exactly what
totally,
you want.
Yes.
Yeah.
After the first couple of nights, he's got it down.
Yep.
You can know. Also turn down, which I think is the biggest part.
Sometimes
for me.
I have yeah. the piano yeah. too hot, but it makes me almost to just so I forces me to play softer.
Yeah.
And there's a connection that happens after a while because initially there's a disjointed yeah. phase, but it goes away if you after a little bit. There still isn't quite the heat of the room.
Totally.
Does not
no, you missed
translate.
That. Sure.
But there's something else you gain.
Well, it must
hearing.
Be sort of like yeah. being in the studio, right?
It's yeah. a lot more like that.
Like sure. when you have some studios, I don't know if they Q-box. Still do, but they used you used to be able to make your own mix.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I used to make it sound as much like a record as I could so that I could find my place. And
yeah.
I just used to pretend
yeah.
it was a finished record.
You could produce yourself,
yeah.
your part
yeah.
in the mix. And
yeah.
The most physically satisfying things yeah. on stage, if you hear something back, it may not be as good as the one where you're
no.
thinking about your dinner or whatever it is. You
right.
know, it's, but, you know, same thing with recording. It's that way, too. But live, I collect bootlegs and stuff.
Yeah.
And if you listen to some of the what may have been the best gigs that people have had, they're not... The crowd is going crazy, but the gig itself is not as good as another one.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Which is another interesting thing. Sometimes, listening to those, I realize something. When people have limited abilities, sometimes they do a lot. They're better performers than people who have more abilities. I mentioned, you know...
they're using 100% of their limited ability.
Well,
which is
if you listen to an old Led Zeppelin bootleg, and then you listen to a Black Sabbath bootleg, right... the Black Sabbath bootlegs usually sound better because they're trying for less. They're doing that song every time.
Want the best?
There's it took me a long time to learn that, but I think playing with Lou Reed was when I really got that.
That's a great,
great playing rhythm guitar and only knowing a few chords, because it was so much fun.
Well, it seems the moral of this episode of The Caffeinated Keyboardist is, as Ralph suggests, learn three guitar chords and put your keyboard aside and get back to basics. Whatever you've learned from today, I hope you enjoyed the episode. John Paterno engineered once again. Samson provided the mics. I'm Jeff Babko. This is The Caffeinated Keyboardist, episode 7. Stay tuned for episode 8. Take care.